Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
When a work for God is to be done, we often ask Ahab's same question. We want to say, by whom? Who's going to do this, Lord? And when many Christian leaders ask this question, they expect that God will answer it by bringing somebody new to them, a leader or a champion who can do the work or at least help with it. But I'll tell you God's normal way of working. God's normal way of working is to use the people that Christian leader already has.
Wouldn't it be so much easier if God would just bring in religious super people to handle all the world's problems? Ministry would be done incredibly well, and there wouldn't be a chance of us messing it up. Pastor David today reminds us that this isn't exactly how God likes to work things out. God wants to use us to do His work in the lives of people immediately around us. We may not think we're qualified, but God does. What's more, God will bless us as we allow Him to use us for His service. Now, here's Pastor David with today's edition of Enduring Word.
He looked around at his army and his military leaders, and he thought, how can God bring victory from these people? And so he says, how are you going to do it? And God said, I'm going to do it through these men. And they said, well, how more are you going to do it? And God told Ahab, I'm going to do it through you. Isn't that amazing? I think that's wonderful. Ahab was in one of these situations where he knew that God wanted to do a work, and he asked the logical question, well, God, who are you going to do this work through? And God basically said, I'm going to do it through you and through the people that you have with you right now, through the captains of the army that you have right now. You see, in Ahab's thinking, help had to come from the outside, right? If God was going to win a dramatic victory, well, you had to send another army. I don't know, the army of Judah, the army of Egypt, the army of somebody. But not the people I have right here, not me. That's what Ahab's thinking. Now, this is an important spiritual principle. When a work for God is to be done, we often ask Ahab's same question. We want to say, by whom? Who's going to do this, Lord? And when many Christian leaders ask this question, they expect that God will answer it by bringing somebody new to them, a leader or a champion who can do the work or at least help with it. But I'll tell you God's normal way of working. God's normal way of working is to use the people that Christian leader already has, even if they seem like a very unlikely army. Now I think of it. I think of just the hypothetical guy who's pastoring a small congregation, you know, and Lord, we need help. We need workers. You know, we need leaders. God, we need leaders for this work. And, you know, he feels God, yes, I'm going to raise up great leaders for the work here. And God says, and the man says to God, well, where are you going to send them? God says, by the people that you have right here. The man blinks, Lord, have you seen the group that you've given me here? They're not exactly leadership potential, God. It looks like a bunch of misfits or people who are too busy or people are this or people, you know. God's way of saying is, you pour into these people that you have. Don't wait for the Lone Ranger to come in on a white horse from the outside. Now listen, maybe God will send the Lone Ranger. Maybe God will send somebody from the outside, but that should not be your concern. You look to raise up leaders from the group God has given you. Think that God is going to use the people that you have right here in front of you. And that's what God told Ahab he was going to do. You see, God would do this work against Syria and Ben-Hadad with an army of only 7,000. And now the work was going to get underway. So look here in verse 16. So they went out at noon. Meanwhile, Ben-Hadad and the 32 kings helping him were getting drunk at the command post. The young leaders of the provinces went out first. And Ben-Hadad sent out a patrol, and they told him, saying, men are coming out of Samaria. So he said, if they've come out for peace, take them alive. And if they've come out for war, take them alive. Now, just stop right there. See what's happening so far here? So far, Ahab says, okay, God, you say you're going to win this victory through the captains of the army that you've given. All right, I'm going to send them out. I'm going to just put them on horses and send them towards the Syrian camp. Who knows what's going to happen? And so when they go, meanwhile, Ben-Hadad and all his kings, what are they doing? They're getting drunk. The same sinful heart that made Ben-Hadad attack Israel also made him a drunk. If you want to look for an underlying reason for the defeat of Ben-Hadad, because I don't need to spoil the story for anybody, but this guy loses. If you want to look for the reason for it, it's simply because his weak moral character. Anyway, he's getting drunk with all of his men. They see this party of captains coming out, you know, here to approach the army. They call, hey, there's people coming from the city of Israelites are coming to us from the city of Samaria. And what does Ben-Hadad see? Did you see it there? What he said in verse 18? If they've come out for peace, take them alive. And if they've come out for a war, take them alive. Does that make sense to you? Does it sound like it's coming from the mouth of a drunk man? I think he's giving confused orders because he's just wasted. You know, he's not thinking clearly. Yeah, you know, if they come out for war, take them alive. And if they come out for peace, take them alive. Or, you know, whatever. He's just not thinking. And so he probably spoke in this drunk confusion and he gave foolish orders to his soldiers. And his soldiers blink and they don't know what to do. You know, everybody's confused. Look what happens here, verse 19. Then these young leaders of the provinces went out of the city with the army which followed them, and each one killed his man. So the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on a horse with the cavalry. Then the king of Israel went out and attacked the horses and the chariots and killed the Syrians with a great slaughter. And the prophet came to the king of Israel and said to him, go, strengthen yourself, take note, and see what you should do, for in the spring of the year the king of Syria will come up against you. So it's a great battle strategy. You know, all Ahab knew was that God said he's going to win a victory through these men. So he said, well, I don't. Let's send these men towards the Syrian camp. And because of the drunkenness of Ben-Hadad, and because of the blessing of God, and because of the moral confusion in the Syrian camp, there was a great victory, and the Syrian army was routed, and they went away. But God didn't want Ahab to celebrate too great, because the Syrian army was going to come back. This nameless prophet here, verse 22, right? Not Elijah. Mr. Nameless Prophet comes again, advises Ahab, and he says, they are going to come back. Now, I want you to notice something. They weren't really prepared for the Syrians when God gave them this great victory that we just read about, right? But yet, God wanted them to prepare for an attack that was to come next year. It's almost as if God is telling Ahab, listen, don't rely on these miracles. Don't think that you can make no preparation. You don't have to worry about Ben-Hadad attacking. You just, you know, live your life carelessly. And then when the crisis comes, says, oh, Lord, send a miracle. No, why don't you start preparing now? Because Ben-Hadad is going to come back with an army again next year. Well, that's what happened here. Verse 23, then the servants of the king of Syria told him, this is great, their gods are gods of the hills. Therefore, they were stronger than we. But if we fight against them in the plain, surely we will be stronger than they. So do this thing. Dismiss the kings, each from their position, and put the captains in their places. And you shall muster an army like an army that you have lost, horse for horse and chariot for chariot. Then we will fight against them in the plain. Surely we will be stronger than they. And he listened to their voice and did so. Now, there's two levels going on here. First of all, there's a military analysis level. And on the military analysis, they say, listen, Ben-Hadad, the strength of our army is in horses and in chariots, and those operate best on a flat fighting surface. And so we shouldn't fight in the hills, which work more to the military advantage of the Israelites. So next time, let's provoke the battle so it's in a situation that's better for us militarily. But that wasn't the primary idea there, was it? The primary idea was a spiritual one, wasn't it? What did he say? It's very interesting there in verse 23. Their God is the God of the hills. Now, the God of the hills can't work so good in the valley. So if we do the battle in the valley, we'll come out ahead. The idea of the localized deity was very prominent in the ancient world. They felt that particular gods had authority over particular areas. And because the recent victory that was won by Israel against Syria was won on hilly terrain, the servants of the king of Syria believed that the God of Israel was a localized deity with power over the hills, but not the plains, not the valleys. I want you to notice something here. They're making a critical mistake, aren't they? They're thinking that the king of Israel is just like their pathetic little molded gods that they make. You know, the gods that they worshipped were these localized deities. Oh, this god's effective here, and that god's effective there, and this god is effective in another place. They don't understand. that God is greater than that. It's easy for us to stand back and criticize them and think of how dumb they are. But I'll tell you this, we make the same mistake today. Many people today think that God is a God of the hills, but not of the plains. They think that God is a God of the past, but not of the present. They think that God has a few special favorites, but he really doesn't treat all his people the same. They think that God is the God of one kind of trial or suffering, but not a trial of another kind. Listen, I think that Satan understands this thinking that we have so easily. He thinks that we believe God can work more easily in one situation than in another. It's kind of hard for me to explain this, but I think you're catching on to the idea. I mean, I think, for example, of the way that people think. They think, you know, it would be better for the church if the church were persecuted. You know, look at how the church thrives in times of persecution, and it would be better. The work of God could go further if the church was persecuted. I just want to say, isn't that right there, thinking that God is the God of the hills, but not of the valleys? That God can bless and protect his church in a time of persecution, but God is somehow helpless to do it for his church in a time of prosperity. You know, God is the God of the hills, but not of the valleys. And you think of this, God can work in one place, but he can't work in another place. How often have we heard that kind of thinking? You especially hear it when people start getting out and doing ministry in other places and in difficult places around the world. They say, well, you know, this is such a tough place where I'm at. And I agree that there are some places where ministry definitely seems tougher than others. But far be it from us to drift off in this area where you think God is the God of America, but not of the third world. He's the God of Western Europe, but he's not the God of the Islamic world. That God is God in one place, but he's not the God of the other place. We have to get this thinking that God is a localized deity out of our head. That's thinking like the servants of the king of Syria, not the servants of the living God. Matter of fact, they felt very bold about this. They said, then we will fight them in the plain. Surely we will be stronger than they. They believed it, and they said, let's act upon this belief. So what happens here? Verse 26. So it was in the spring of the year that Ben-Hadad mustered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were mustered and given provisions, and they went against them. Now the children of Israel encamped before them like two little flocks of goats, like the Syrians filled the countryside. Isn't that a great description of this? You see this massive, massive Syrian army filling hill after hill after hill. You look at the Israelite army, looks like two little flocks of goats on the hillside. They look like lambs to the slaughter, don't they? It doesn't look good for Israel. Then a man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, by the way, Elisha? No, another anonymous man of God. A man of God came and spoke to the king of Israel and said, thus says the Lord, because the Syrians have said, the Lord is God of the hills, but he is not God of the valleys, therefore I will deliver all this great multitude into your hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Now, I want you to notice this. When Ben-Hadad came back again to avenge the loss that he had the year before, he came back with an overwhelming force. He didn't want to risk another humiliation. And it also makes you wonder if Ben-Hadad really took this business of gods of hills and valleys very seriously. Because he said, you know, our God may be the God of the valleys, but we're going to bring an awfully big army with us also. But at least some of the Syrians really believe this. That the Lord is the God of the hills, he's not the God of the valleys. And God says that because of this, I'm going to deliver all this great multitude into the hands of the Israelites who are vastly outnumbered. Now I want you to notice something here. God took the bad theology of the Syrians as a personal insult. We don't often think about that, do we? That bad theology insults God. We often, as a matter of fact, think just the opposite. We almost think, well, you know, look, God's a big God, and he doesn't really care what people think about him. What, you think God's like on some insecurity trip, and you know, he's worried about what people think about him? No, that's not the matter at all. Our God is a great God, and when lies are told about him, it bothers him. When we hold and choose to hold in our mind wrong beliefs about God, it insults him. He has every reason to believe that you don't understand him. You don't care to understand him. It's just like this. You wonder how God would say, you think I'm a God of grace, but not of righteousness, instead of the hills and the valleys thing. You think I'm a God of a comfort, but not of power. Our wrong understanding of God can be a grave insult of him. It can take away from his glory and his majesty, and it never adds to it. God resented their blasphemy, and he was determined to punish it. He was going to show them, my power is everywhere. Don't you call me a God of the hills. I'm going to show you that my power is present in the valleys as well. So, I hope Ahab was feeling better about this with his little two flocks of goats there on the hillside, so to speak, but a message from the prophet of God. Now, let me remind you of something before we look at verse 29. Do you think that for some reason there had been great spiritual revival in the life of Ahab? No. Again, we always want to think that if God saves, if God blesses, it's because, you know, some leader is so spiritual, and that's why God is doing it. Personally, leaders love to cultivate that idea. You know, if God's really blessing, it's because the leader is so spiritual. I want you to think that, you know, of anything I'm associated with, that if God's blessing it, well, of course, it's because I'm so spiritual. And isn't that why God blesses it? But, you know, it's crazy, isn't it? God's blessing or the perceived lack of blessing may have nothing to do with the leader. Nothing. You can't make rules about such things. You can't say, well, all the good ones are blessed and all the bad ones are cursed, or the other way around. You can make no laws about this. In these things, many times the ways of God are past finding out. Some of the most godly pastors I know, I can think of some right now, I can think through the business cards in my mind right now, some incredibly godly pastors, man, they just struggle. And I don't know why. I wish I had their character. I wish I had their integrity. I wish I had their godliness. And yet I see, and man, their ministry is just a struggle. And then I know other pastors who seem to have great success, one field or another, and I look and I just say, man, you know, what's going on with that? Lord, how are you blessing that? But I want you to know, this is carnal thinking when we think, well, you know, God's blessing all the good boys and he's penalizing all the bad boys. You can't figure it out that way. You just cannot figure it out that way. And so we see God showing great mercy and blessing to Ahab, who was an unrighteous, ungodly man, but he's doing it for his name's sake and for his people's sake. He's not doing it for Ahab's sake, but for his name's sake and for his people's sake. All right, now verse 29. And they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. So it was on the seventh day that the battle was joined, and the children of Israel killed 100,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians in 1 day. But the rest fled to Aphek, into the city. Then a wall fell on 27,000 of the men who were left, and Ben-Hadad fled and went to the city into an inner chamber. I think this is wonderful, because this was clearly a miracle, yet it was a miracle working through the existing Israeli army, which was like a flock of goats compared to the size of the Syrian army. God wanted to show that as unlikely as it seemed, he could work through this outwardly weak and ineffective instrument. But then God threw in a little bit of the supernatural after that. After the great victory on the battlefield, God moved in other extraordinary ways, like pushing over that wall on the 27,000 Syrians that had escaped to Aphek. And he really wanted to show, look, I'm not just going to let you think that Israel has beat you. I have beat you as well. And so there was a tremendous, tremendous victory for Israel. Again, not just in the hills, but in the valleys as well. Verse 31. Then his servant said to him, look, now we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. These are the advisors and the assistants to Ben-Hadad. We've heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Please let us put sackcloth around our waists and ropes around our heads and go out to the king of Israel. Perhaps he will spare your life. So they wore sackcloth around their waists and put ropes around their heads and came to the king of Israel and said, Your servant Ben-Hadad says, please let me live. And he said, is he alive? He is still my brother. Now the men were watching closely to see whether a sign of mercy would come from him. And they quickly grasped at his word and said, your brother Ben-Hadad. So he said, go bring him. Then Ben-Hadad came out to him. He had him come up into the chariot. So Ben-Hadad said to him, the cities which my father took from your father, I will restore. And you may set up marketplaces for yourself in Damascus, as my father did in Samaria. Then Ahab said, I will send you away with this treaty. So he made a treaty with him and sent him away. Isn't it fascinating? Not long before this, Ben-Hadad spoke severe threats against Ahab and all the kingdom of Israel. Remember that whole, God do so to me and more if my servants can each get a handful of dust from the city of Samaria and all that kind of business. Now, he humbled himself as much as he could to win mercy and favor from the unexpectedly triumphant king of Israel. By the way, I don't want to over-spiritualize this too much, but I think it's a wonderful thing for sinners to come to God, the king, with the same manner as Ben-Hadad came to Ahab. Come with sincerity, come with humility, come with surrender, come with earnestness, and come close, I love this, watching to see whether any sign of mercy would come to them. I love that. The idea of a sinner coming to God, humbly surrendered, and then just looking to God, are you going to show me any sign of mercy? Do you have a sign of mercy for me? And of course, God will show this kind of mercy. But unfortunately, Ahab should not have shown mercy to the king of Syria. That's not what God wanted him to do. You see, Ahab felt a kinship towards this pagan king with these very pagan ideas of God. Perhaps Ahab wanted Ben-Hadad and Syria's friendship and protection against other political alliances that were building around the world. If that's the case, he was looking for friends in the wrong places, and he had no business making the treaty that's described there in verses 33 and 34. The victory was the Lord's. The victory didn't belong to Ahab. Ahab is negotiating away the Lord's victory, and I don't think the Lord's going to be happy with that. So here, he's doing what he should not do, but now we come here to verse 35 and see our next anonymous prophet going to speak here to Ahab. Look at it here. Now, a certain man of the sons of the prophets said to his neighbor by the word of the Lord, strike me, please. And the man refused to strike him. Stop. You got to put a little pause right here. Some things in the Bible are just kind of weird. Okay, we admit that. This is one of those just kind of weird passages. We're introduced to a prophet who goes up to, you can just imagine, knocking on the door. Hello, hi. I suppose maybe this other guy is another one of the sons of the prophets. We don't know for certain, but maybe it's sort of implied in the text. Hi, can you do me a favor? Can you strike me, please? No, I'm not going to do that. Now, I want you to notice again, this is another anonymous prophet, another anonymous man of God who's here busy. Do you think God is trying to get a message through to us here? Elijah, Elisha, we're not alone. God had many others, and God would work through many others. We have this tendency, don't we? We look at ourselves, we look at the people around us in our circle, and we think, well, that's where God's working, nowhere else. No, listen, God has many people who can do many great works beyond our own vision, and we should be thankful for it.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. there's a secure option to give right on the homepage of EnduringWord.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at EnduringWord.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.